This is Audible.
Audible Studios presents Rhett and Link's Book of Mythicality, a field guide to curiosity, creativity, and tomfoolery. Written and performed by Rhett McLaughlin and Link Neal.
In memory of Ben Greenwood.
His friendship changed our lives, but ended way too soon.
A mythical welcome.
You did it. You have officially made at least one good decision today. By opening this book, you are opening yourself up to the very real possibility of increased mythicality in your life. Why exactly you decided to open this book is not important. Maybe you heard that this book contains a skyscraper-shaped board game that builds character. True. A visual guide to slow dancing poses. True. Apocalyptic theme party ideas. True. And actual sheet music and lyrics for the song we want you to sing and hopefully play on the organ at our funeral. Also true. Or maybe you opened this book because you wanted to see pictures from the time Link broke his pelvis. Hilarious unless you were Link.
Or read about the time Rhett was confronted by a tattooed man while wearing a child's shirt. It didn't turn out well. Or perhaps you heard that one chapter of this book was written by our wives. A very risky decision. And another entire chapter was written from the future. The United States Department of Time Travel and Extraterrestrial Affairs will not permit us to confirm nor deny the validity of said chapter from the future. Regardless of your reasons, all that matters now is that, by opening this book, you have just merged onto the highway to mythicality.
It would probably be helpful to tell you what mythicality is, if you don't happen to know already. Here's a technical-sounding definition. Mythicality, noun. The quality or state of being that embodies a synergistic coalescence of curiosity, creativity, and tomfoolery, sometimes referred to as curio-tomfoolivity, ideally experienced in the context of friendship and intended to bring goodwill to the universe. Origin, 2009, Rhett and Linkish.
You may think you can't go around adding ITY to any word you want and then giving it your own meaning, but in the age of the internet, you can. Especially when there isn't already a definition that communicates exactly what you're trying to say. Mythicality is the word we've come up with that captures what's been at the heart of our friendship from the very beginning. We'll unpack it in layman's terms in a moment, but first, some background might be helpful.
We met in 1984 on the first day of first grade at Buies Creek Elementary School in Buies Creek, North Carolina, when our teacher, Miss Locklear, held us both in from recess for writing profanity on our desks. Hell and damn, if you're wondering. Damn spelled D-A-M. Spelling wasn't Link's strongest subject. She then sentenced us to coloring pictures of mythical beasts. We've been best friends ever since.
Over 20 years later, when YouTube was invented, we began uploading videos of questionable quality like cutting strangers' nose hairs at the mall and the Unibrow song. These videos are still online, although we strongly advise against watching them if you have an active cringe reflex. Surprisingly, and thankfully, enough people responded positively to these videos to encourage us to make more.
In 2009, we began to get a sense that there should be a name for this group of individuals who had collectively determined that we were more funny than obnoxious. So, we took the easy way out and asked them to name themselves. After members of the Rhett and Link community, an online fan site, threw around a number of suggestions including unicorn holers and wrinkles, we all eventually settled on mythical beasts.
Since then, we've gotten a little carried away with incorporating the term mythical into our lives. In 2012, when we decided to launch a daily morning talk show, we naturally named it Good Mythical Morning. We founded Mythical Entertainment, created the Mythical Mail Boulder, the Mythical Mail Museum, and the Wheel of Mythicality, and sold a mythical shoe, a good mythical mug, and a mythical pomade. It's gotten a bit out of hand, we know.
Of course, this terminology has been a bit confusing for those other than the mythical beasts. When we tell strangers that we have a show called Good Mythical Morning, we can sense their suspicion that the show only exists in our imaginations and that we are actually unemployed.
But for us, mythicality encompasses all of the qualities that we want our work, our friendship, and our lives to display. It's characterized by a desire to learn and do new things, an appreciation of originality, and a tendency to not take yourself too seriously. A person who is willing to risk pursuing these values for the purpose of making the world a better place is a true mythical beast.
We firmly believe that you can approach any aspect of your life with mythicality, from the way you comb your hair to the way you say I love you. And that's what we hope to demonstrate in this book. For us, it turns out that many of the experiences throughout our lifelong friendship, including hitchhiking, eating leeches and spiders, floating in a sensory deprivation tank, and even throwing balls at each other's balls, have all helped to shape our understanding of what mythicality is all about.
In addition to our stories, this book contains a collection of guides, charts, and activities to help you navigate a host of life situations with mythicality, like a laughter compatibility test to take with a friend, a decision tree to consult if you get flipped off by a stranger, and step-by-step instructions on how to eat nasty foods, just to name a few. There are also mythical merit badges at the opening of each chapter so you can track your progress. This is largely because we have a personal merit badge void that we've been trying to fill ever since we both dropped out of Cub Scouts after only one meeting.
Of course, you could just read this book and not actually do anything we suggest. We have no way of knowing unless you have one of the 5 copies of this book that has a small, imperceptible microphone and camera on the cover. But you're listening to the audiobook, and we couldn't figure out how to implant a microphone or camera into the audiobook. It's only 2017 when we're reading this.
If you're new to our mythical world, welcome, and don't be scared. If you already consider yourself one of the mythical herd, thank you. One of the most mythical parts of our lives is being able to share our work with beasts worldwide. Without you, we would have never been given the opportunity to write this book.
By choosing to read it, you're demonstrating that you want to be your mythical best. If you stole this book, you can probably still return it, assuming you have not already drooled excessively on it or otherwise defaced it. If you can't work up the courage to return it, at least finish reading it, and then give it to someone you care about. Oh, and stop stealing. Of course, this is the audio book, which is stolen in a different way. Hopefully you're not listening to a stolen version.
Chapter 1. Laugh Your Way Into Friendship.
When we upload an internet video, the primary response we're hoping for is laughter. That's a tad ironic considering that we have no way to see or hear anyone laughing. Instead, we must scan user comments for comedic validation, and that means wading through remarks like, "You guys are running out of ideas," or, "Who else is eating chicken parm while watching this?" If we're lucky enough to stumble upon a hee-hee-hee-hee-hee-hee or a mwahahahaha, or even a coveted tears of joy emoji, it's not nearly as satisfying as hearing someone authentically burst into laughter.
Thankfully, we have each other. Before we were ever trying to get people on the internet to indicate amusement with their keyboards, we were making each other laugh. To this day, we know we have succeeded in truly landing the joke when it causes us to begin giggling together like a couple of toddlers who just broke out of daycare. We readily acknowledge that toddlers breaking out of daycare is only funny for the toddlers.
There are probably best friends out there who spend most of their time together just somberly talking about impending global pandemics and financial collapse. We love a good apocalyptic conversation as much as the next person, but we found that sharing a laugh is a true sweet spot where two hallmarks of mythicality, humor and friendship, meet. It was this nexus of mythicality that first opened the door to our lifelong companionship.
From the time I was 4 years old until I met Rhett when I was 6, I was determined to have a best friend. I was desperate for a best friend. My first attempt to find one was in preschool with Brad McDonald. We had fun digging holes together, so I figured he was my best friend. Then, one afternoon while venturing into the bathroom just after Brad finished his business, I saw it. He'd forgotten to flush and had left behind a memento. It was orange. I'm talking cheese puff orange. It was wrong to hold Brad's orange poop against him. He probably just drank a crap ton, pun intended, of Fanta, or maybe he was secretly addicted to creamsicles. But whatever the reason, it scarred me deeply, and I could no longer consider Brad my BFF. I guess I was a pretty ruthless 4-year-old. My second attempt at best friendship came in kindergarten. Most days, the highlight of recess involved some kind of foot race, and I was determined to become friends with the fastest kid. I was among the slowest runners, but I figured that all great friendships should involve some realistic average speed so that no duo is too fast or too slow. I thought way too much about this. Sadly, the fastest kid, Maurice Cameron, was already best friends with Linwood Campbell. So, I set my sights on the second fastest kid, Matthew Enzor. I tried complimenting him after one of his silver medal performances, only to realize that he was already committed to a best friendship with a slow-moving blonde kid named JR. My search for a speedy best friend was going nowhere fast. My third and final pre-Rhett best friend getting attempt came later that kindergarten year. I figured, since targeting the fastest kid had failed, why not try the biggest one? And Zach West was the size of a third grader. Surely he would like a little friend to balance things out. I began talking to Zach, and he talked back. After a few days, he even asked me to come over to his house. This was working. He was going to be my best friend. While at Zach's house, he asked if I wanted to play wrestling. I loved wrestling and anticipated Zach pulling out a full WWF pro wrestling toy set just like the one I had at home. Yeah, I told him excitedly. Before I knew it, Zach had me by the legs, upside down in a pile driver position on his bed, and proceeded to jackhammer me head first off the bed and into the floor. His grandma was watching. I never went back to Zach's house. On the first day of first grade, I met Rhett, and I knew that he was best friend material. First off, he was tall, so there was the whole average height between us factor. He was also pretty fast, even though it looked like he was moving slow because his legs were so long. I never saw his poop to gauge its orangeness, but he never attempted to pile drive me, so I eased up on the background check. Plus, just a few days into our friendship, he asked if he could spend the night at my house, which meant that he knew that I was best friend material too.
What Link didn't realize at the time is that I had some sort of inexplicable compulsion to invite myself over to spend the night at other kids' homes. It's strange because as an adult, I like to spend the night in my own house in my own bed. But as a child, I would jump at the first opportunity to invite myself over, sometimes in the first conversation I ever had with someone. I would just wait for a pause and say, "So you think I could spend the night at your house?" This was a surprisingly effective tactic in elementary school. Kids almost always just said, "Okay, I'll ask my parents." And their parents almost always said yes. I was fascinated with figuring out how other people's families worked, or more precisely, what they ate. I would open up the refrigerators to see what was in there. David Rogers' family were fans of cold cuts. Peter Dinklage's, not that Peter Dinklage, parents enjoyed large quantities of Capri Sun. I was also interested in what other parents would let us get away with. I watched the Texas Chainsaw Massacre at Adam Nicholson's house and ate unlimited Cocoa Puffs at Tate Maddox's house. So when Link started talking to me, I wasn't looking for a best friend. I was just looking to infiltrate yet another home. When I invited myself, he didn't passively say that he'd ask his parents like other kids. He pounced. "Yes, tonight! Tonight is good!" I was a little taken aback at his eagerness. When I showed up at his house, I proceeded with my usual family evaluation. He had a stepdad named Jimmy who started a big fire in the backyard and then threw cups of gasoline on it. This seemed unsafe, so I was very into it. He also had a pantry full of Little Debbie treats of nearly every variety. I wasn't accustomed to this, so I had 2 fudge rounds and 2 oatmeal cream pies in under 10 minutes. Later that night, as I lay there trying to go to sleep, I noticed that there was something different about spending the night at Link's house. It wasn't just that I smelled like a bonfire, or that I had never experienced a sugar high quite like a Little Debbie sugar high. It was that I was laughing. We were laughing. A lot. I don't recall the specifics of what made us laugh that night, and I can only imagine how silly and stupid it was. I'm sure it was just the typical 6-year-old boy fare of saying the word "but" and laughing for 3 minutes straight. But it was an intense, infectious laughter. We made each other laugh.
I had no idea that Rhett was thinking any of this. I was just happy that he hadn't tried a wrestling move on me. But I remember that roaring laughter as well. I had never laughed like that with a friend. I figured that this is what best friends did. Our ability to make each other laugh uncontrollably served as the foundation of our friendship, and every time we did, we poured a little more cement onto that foundation. Our adolescence was defined by our relentless commitment to amuse each other, and the setting for this was often the balcony at Buies Creek First Baptist Church. Instead of listening to Pastor Rogers preach, we would take the little white cards used for reserving a spot at the Wednesday night family dinner, turn them over, and write absolutely ridiculous deep thoughts on them. We were inspired by SNL's recurring deep thoughts with Jack Handy, but as you can see, we didn't exactly achieve the comedic genius that Jack did.
Here's one that I wrote. "Sometimes I think of the hair on my head as a tropical rainforest. And when I go to the barber to get my hair cut, right before the barber starts to cut my hair, I stand up and say, 'Hey,
You're about to kill millions of little animals and destroy our Earth. Then I sit down and say, just kidding.
And here's one for me. When I ride down the highway, I see dead deer on the roadside. I'll pick these deer up and put them in my trunk. When I get home, I show my children all the deer, and they say, Daddy, why are there tire marks on all of them? And I reply, I am a great hunter, and I found these dead deer on the side of the road where they were hit, and I caught them. That day, I felt like a hero. These may not strike you as precursors to a career in comedy, but at that point it didn't matter that no one else found this stuff funny. When we passed the cards back and forth during the church service, it took everything in us to contain our laughter. We would sit there, bending over in boisterous snickering, our faces turning red as we thought about rainforest hair or bringing dead deer home to our hungry families. Mrs. Lanier, one of our school teachers, was in the choir that sat behind Pastor Rogers, giving her a great view of the whole congregation. Each time Rhett and I would begin to lose it, she would shoot a look up to the balcony directly at us like the eye of Sauron.
Mrs. Lanier's scolding didn't stop us. We continued to view every setting as an opportunity to crack each other up. This was captured perfectly in the notes we wrote to each other in our high school yearbooks. My note to Link. Link Neal, a.k.a. Charles Lincoln Smith Johnson Adrian Muhammad Neal III. You have 14 different things going for you, but I can only mention one. You have soul. When I say soul, I'm not talking about the kind of soul that Veronica Swan said you had, but I'm talking about the kind that Run DMC talks about. Run DMC spelled three different ways, by the way. If you got the soul, then keep the soul. If you don't got the soul, then get the soul. Fart blossoms only come once a year, so don't let them pass by you. If you try hard, you can catch one in a net. If you don't catch one, then buy one. I'm sure your granddad has plenty. Rico, a.k.a. Stupid. P.S. I wanted to do something that would mess up your yearbook, so look down. Then, in big letters at the bottom, I wrote, Rusty Jernigan.
This is my note to Rhett. Rhett, thanks to you, I have been inspired by the best inspirationalist, Merle. And of course, Merle 94 will soon be a landmarking event in our lives. I wish the buck was still silver. It was back when the country was strong. I wish my penis was gold. I'd be rich, 'cause it is so long. I wish the Ford and the Chevy would still last 10 years like they should, and me and you both would drive our S-10s all in the woods. Never forget, it don't get better than Merle. Brooks and Dunn is a close second. Link.
I thought it was funny to sign a name other than my own as I waxed eloquent about fart blossoms, and Link figured I would appreciate him rewriting Merle Haggard lyrics. Haggard's our favorite singer. More on him later. In order to brag about his manhood and contemplate the possibility of using it as currency. We were both right.
It would prove strategic that we didn't spend all of our time just trying to make each other laugh. We learned pretty early on that we could also make our friends laugh at us. We sought to turn every class project and event into a vehicle to deliver our comedy to an audience.
When we were told that Buies Creek Elementary would be holding its first fall festival in 1991, and that it would feature a bake sale, games, and live musical performances in the school auditorium, we asked our teachers if we could sing a Halloween-themed song. Without knowing our full plan, they agreed.
Naughty by Nature had just released their new hit rap single, OPP, and it had taken our school by storm. None of us had any idea what the lyrics meant, but that didn't really matter because we decided to overhaul the song and turn it into what we considered to be a hilarious rap about All Hallows Eve.
We simply replaced OPP with Halloween. It was the same number of syllables, fitting the chorus perfectly. Thankfully, we were able to find the actual original lyrics we wrote down in 1991.
I'd like to have your attention for just a little minute so I can bust a rhyme and tell you what's in it. It's about a holiday that's coming up, so listen closely to this rhyme and don't interrupt.
We're in the house, the auditorium, and straight from B.C., where we're coming from. Rhett and Link on the microphone, rocking so hard you think you in the Twilight Zone.
It's kind of funky, a little bit spunky. You can dress like Frankenstein, or you can dress like a junkie.
The holiday is Halloween. where you can walk outside and see what you never seen. It's a time to read books by Stephen King and also a time to hear your doorbell ring.
It's where you give candy in the little handy, all the way from Almond Joy to the Good and Plenty. Be aware for the Wolfman if you want to keep your right leg and left hand.
'Cause he'll come and get you in the middle of the night. What you think about that? Yeah, right. It's just something you never seen. And here comes the chorus. Halloween. You down with Halloween?
Yeah, you know me.
You down with Halloween?
Yeah, you know me.
You down with Halloween?
Yeah, you know me.
You down with Halloween?
All the homies. Halloween is a spooky time, but to tell you the truth, that's why I wrote this rhyme. For you to listen to, and if you don't mind, I'd like you to do something a little bit crazy. Come on, party people, and don't be lazy.
Throw your hands in the air with the beat, because you know the beat is kind of sweet. Well, let's get back to the main issue about how Halloween really, really gets you.
You down with Halloween?
Yeah, you know me.
You down with Halloween?
Yeah, you know me.
You down with Halloween?
Yeah, you know me.
You down with Halloween?
All the ladies.
Our teachers didn't necessarily appreciate us suggesting that the student body was free to dress like a junkie for Halloween, and no one actually threw their hands in the air when we asked. That didn't matter. We had developed our own sense of humor that served as a language between the two of us. If we were operating solo, we may have been discouraged by the lack of response. But because we had each other, and we were convinced that what we were doing was hilarious, we were willing to shamelessly put ourselves out there.
Years later, when we joined YouTube in the summer of 2006, the potential for a captive audience increased exponentially beyond those gathered in the Buies Creek Elementary Auditorium. And even though the initial response to our first videos was lukewarm at best, we kept moving forward, using our ability to entertain each other as motivation.
People often ask us how we've managed to remain friends for so long, and they sometimes ask in a slightly accusatory manner, as if they assume that our friendship must have been manufactured by the top brass at YouTube in order to generate clicks. It's difficult for people to believe that two kids can meet in first grade and then choose to work together for a lifetime. Granted, it's a little unusual, but it's not a conspiracy like the moon landing, Tupac's death, or a spherical Earth. We're actually best friends. And one of the reasons is that our job is to make each other laugh nearly every day of our lives.
Maybe we would still be best friends if we were in a different line of work. We could have been librarians, spending our days amusing each other by reorganizing books counter to the Dewey Decimal System, or massage therapists doing celebrity impressions while administering couples massages. While both of those careers sound incredibly fulfilling and profitable, there's no doubt that it has been easier to maintain our BFF status because of our profession.
We're not trying to pressure you into convincing your best friend that the only way you're going to sustain your friendship is by starting a YouTube channel together. You shouldn't start a YouTube channel. We don't need the competition.
But maybe you're on a best friend hunt like Link, and you've already tried and failed with the fastest people you know. Our first piece of advice is to place less importance on your potential friend's foot speed. You're only increasing the chances that you're the one who's going to get eaten by a grizzly bear when the two of you finally go on that Yellowstone camping trip.
Instead, find a friend you can laugh with. There are a few things that set the bond in a mythical friendship better than that. Getting stranded on a deserted island together or being held captive by a cannibalistic tribe is probably more effective, but it's hard to organize such things, and we doubt it's worth the risk. GMM's biggest laughs.
We don't spend the night at each other's houses anymore so we can have giggle-filled sleepovers. We leave that to our kids.
Our most epic bouts of laughter happen on Good Mythical Morning.
Episode 573, Upside Down Glasses Challenge. Link miserably failed at pouring liquid into a bottle while wearing special prism glasses.
Episode 719, Will It Cookie, Taste Test. Rhett adopted a Scottish accent and exclaimed, "Brother Link breaks out the beans and franks, cookies, to help Link eat a haggis cookie."
Episode 451, Spotting a Fake Laugh. After watching footage of Link fake laughing, Rhett laughed and said that laugh was fake, which made him laugh again. Real. They both laughed.
Episode 457, Squeezable Food Test. Link squeezed a solidified log of soggy frosted mini-wheats into Rhett's mouth.
Episode 680, Testing the Butter Cutter. Retina suggested that she would brush Linkita's hair back to signal when she wanted to speak.
Episode 166, How to Make Someone Sound Like an Idiot. Link gave a severely slurred speech about cinnamon buns ice cream while using a homemade speech jammer.
Episode 674, Weirdest Things Found in Toilets. Rhett roleplayed as a naked man found by police waist-deep in a porta-john. Man, if I told y'all, you wouldn't believe me.
Episode 473, Introducing Pool Pants. Link filled Rhett's pool shirt with water and showered under a huge leak from Rhett's belly button region. The evolution of our comedy.
In middle school, we set out to write a screenplay for a film called Gutless Wonders. We filled the story with things that made us laugh at the time.
We decided to take the two-page opening scene and analyze it through a modern lens to see if the current Rhett and Link will laugh at the stuff that the young Rhett and Link thought was funny. I'll be reading the script.
I'll be providing our current day analysis.
Fade in. Scene 1. Intro. Peaceful scenery. Rhett, speaking in an English accent.
English accents make people take you seriously, even if you're trying to be funny. This was a good instinct.
Rhett voiceover. In the great era of time we call the late 70s, two landmarking events occurred. Rhett McLaughlin and Link Neal were born. Cut to Rhett as a baby. Rhett emerged from his mother's womb, his body weighing 6 pounds, 5 ounces, and his gargantuan noggin weighing 7 pounds, 8 ounces, for a total weight of 13 pounds, 13 ounces.
Of course, our humor has always been pretty self-centered. This hasn't changed significantly. And large heads are always funny. This joke worked. However, enlarged CGI baby heads may blow production budget.
Cut to Link as a baby. Rhett Vio. Link came into this world, his body weighing 6 pounds, 3 ounces, and his unbelievably huge noggin weighing 8 pounds, 4 ounces, for a total combined weight of 14 pounds, 7 ounces.
This was an opportunity to introduce a new joke, but we went with the big head angle again. A miss. Plus, budget definitely doesn't allow for two CGI heads.
Cut to both. Rhett Vio. Little did they know at this young age that one day they would come to be known as the two of the greatest blooming idiots.
Self-deprecation takes the edge off this selfish comedy. Smart move.
To ever walk the face of this green, blue, brown, with hues of yellow, earth.
Unnecessary specificity was and still is funny.
Good old boy starts while showing both his babies.
We didn't understand music licensing at the time. This should read, royalty-free good old boys sound alike.
Cut to credit. Starring. Cut to Rhett and Link as young kids playing catch with one another, hitting each other with the ball. They start fighting.
Violence can be funny, but the details are important. We should have been more specific, like Link bites Rhett's ear.
Credit. Link Neal. Cut to young Link fishing, has a big one. Young Rhett comes out of the water. They fight.
Seems like we're building to something here. Again, not bad, but more details are needed, like Rhett bites Link's ear.
Credit. Rhett McLaughlin. Young Rhett playing golf. Swings. Shows divot fly. Shows it hitting young Link in the face.
After the manfish joke, you want a third beat that is even better. A simple golf divot joke is a step backwards and a miss.
They fight.
Comedy comes in three, so the third fight is the right call. But again with the details. This has to be the funniest beat. Example, Rhett and Link bite a third guy's ear.
Credit. Screenplay by Rhett M. and Link N. Good old boys fades out. Cut to farmer played by Rhett, standing in front of his field. Farmer.
This is where things begin to go off the rails. Not only are we already playing another character, but it's a cliche.
Yeah, I remember those boys. Spits. Back in the summer of 83, they whizzed all over my tobacco crop.
We still resort to potty humor regularly, more than we would like. This one's not bad, especially considering we use the word whizzed, which is inherently funny.
Huh. Of course, it still ended up the best tasting stogies we had since 77. Credit. Produced by Link N. and Rhett M. Cut to Phil Juby watering the lawn. Phil. Oh, I knew those kids. They'd always press their faces against my kitchen window when we were eating supper. They looked real hungry, so I threw some scraps out to them. Man, they attacked those things like wild hyenas.
We wanted Michael Juby's dad, Phil, to be in our movie because he was the coolest dad we knew. Problem is, we didn't give a joke. This monologue has nothing to offer. Miss.
Credit. Featuring Ronald McNeil, Chris Gardner, Trent Hamilton, Jason Keenan, Michael Juby, Phil Juby, Brandon Tart, Sue Capps, Diane McLaughlin, and Jim McLaughlin. Cut to Link as an old woman.
Cross-dressing can be humorous, but a confused older woman is simply another cliche. This was an opportunity to introduce original characters, and we didn't.
Old woman. Who? I can't. I won't. I don't know. Points at camera. What's that contraption, Sonny? Gets frightened.
Someone thinking a camera is a weapon could have been funny, but the audience can't see the camera. We didn't think about that. Fail.
It's a bazooka. Help. Help. Bazooka. Bazooka. Credit. Directed by Rhett M. and Link N. Chapter 2.
Get Lost.
We didn't have GPS growing up, just directions. We're not talking about a robotic lady in our pockets telling us exactly when to turn left. We relied on a handwritten list of turns, road names, and distances, like this.
Go 3.2 miles on Old Buies Creek Road. Take a left on Highway 27 at the First Baptist Church. Go 1.7 miles until you see the Second Baptist Church.
Take a right on Sheriff Jerry Joe Johnson Jr. Road. Go 0.8 miles. The Third Baptist Church is on the left. If you pass the Methodist Church without a steeple, you've gone too far.
We would take this sheet of paper with us in the car or on our bikes. If we misplaced it or a rogue wind blew it into a ditch, we probably ended up lost. We may have even had to stop and ask another actual person for directions. This is how we lived. It was so barbaric.
Things are different now. It's difficult to get lost. Sure, you might read a news story about some dude spending a year lost at sea, having to decide whether or not to eat his dead friend or his own legs, but that kind of thing doesn't happen to you. No, you can pull out a phone and find your exact location on a map of the entire world pretty much any time. If you're asked how long it will take to walk to Fuquay Varina, North Carolina from virtually any location in North America, you can give an answer in under 20 seconds, assuming you know how to spell Fuquay Varina, which is never a sure thing.
We were lucky to have grown up during a unique navigational era, somewhere between the present day and a forgotten time when people used the stars, the sun, or the old licking your fingertip and holding it up in the wind technique to get around. That last one might actually just be for kicking field goals, but whatever. As kids, it was pretty easy to get lost, and we did it a lot. Turns out that getting lost with a friend is a pretty mythical thing to do.
We lived on opposite sides of our hometown, Buies Creek. On any given Saturday morning, we'd meet at the graveyard. We met there for two reasons. First, saying, "Let's meet at the graveyard," made us feel like gangsters. More practically, it was our best guess as to the halfway point between our houses. Looking at Google Maps today, it turns out that I was a little farther away, but Rhett had to cross a major highway on his bike and go up a hill, so it kind of evened out. After we met up at the graveyard, the operative question was very simple. Which direction should we go today? We didn't use actual navigational terms like north or south, but rather a simple point of the finger accompanied by that way. After deciding on a direction, we'd start pedaling. We had no helmets, no food, and no water. Just ourselves and our bikes.
We seldom stuck to paved roads, opting instead to explore the woods. My bike was a Walmart special, while Link's bike was a little nicer and said Yosemite on it. Having no point of reference for Yosemite National Park, he pronounced it Yosemite. One Saturday, we followed a forest clearing that fanned out from the local wastewater treatment plant. After a few miles, it ran into a dirt road we had never seen before. We rode along the road until we were ambushed by two wildly aggressive pit bulls, who chased us for a few seconds before they were called off by a young boy. It was our classmate Chris Barefoot's little brother. Strangely, he was wearing shoes at the time. After seeing a house, we put it together that this was where the Barefoots lived. We were suddenly struck with a strange feeling of accomplishment. Lewis and Clark followed the Missouri River and saw the Pacific Ocean. Rhett and Link followed a sewage clearing and saw the Barefoots' house. We continued on the dirt road until it hit the highway, at which point we gained an appreciation for just how far we'd come. It was too late in the day to go back through the woods, and we would have had to ride our bikes on a four-lane highway for miles if we took the road. So we decided to do something we'd only seen in the movies. We stood next to the road and stuck out our thumbs. After 10 minutes or so, a truck driven by two good old boys stopped and asked us where we were going. We said, back to Bowie's Creek. And they responded, hop in. We threw our bikes and ourselves into the truck bed and rode down Highway 421 like two kings on a palanquin. We were freaking hitchhikers. House discovering hitchhikers, to be exact. A disclaimer, we don't recommend hitchhiking if you don't live in Bowie's Creek, North Carolina in the 1980s.
Once Rhett got his license, we recreated the getting lost routine on a larger scale in his parents' Dodge Dynasty. He'd roll up to my house, I'd get in, and we'd pick a direction and drive. We'd put in a mixtape full of songs by Merle Haggard and listen to the first side as we traveled down the road, eventually crossing the Harnett County line. There was no discernible difference in the landscape once we entered a neighboring county, just more endless blacktop cutting through farms and communities so small they weren't even considered towns. Still, it seemed like a foreign land and made us feel like pioneers. There was something electric about the unknown, about giving ourselves over to the fate of North Carolina country roads for a couple of hours. It was precisely the fact that we didn't know the end that made it worth the drive. Once the first side of the mixtape was done, we'd stop driving. If we were lucky, we'd find a convenience store that we'd never been to before and drop in to get a cold mellow yellow before flipping over the tape and driving home. A few weeks later, we'd pick a new direction. We were addicted to the process of choosing a direction and just going. Eventually, we explored just about every road in Harnett County. If there was ever a draw a map of Harnett County from memory contest, we would stand a good chance of winning.
We didn't know it at the time, but our tendency to drive without a destination prepared us well for adulthood. When we set out into the recesses of rural North Carolina years ago, we were fostering a sense of discovery that scratched our mythical itch of curiosity. We were reinforcing the idea that sometimes the most important part of the journey is just deciding to go.
That should be an inspirational quote poster. To be clear, we haven't done much literal pick a direction and drive lately. The smog levels in Los Angeles are already bad enough without us taking joyrides across town. And if we decided to ride bikes instead, getting lost in hitchhiking might turn out a little differently here than it did in Harnett County. We might get a ride home, but we'd probably have to give up our bikes for it, or at least the front wheels.
Instead of driving, we've applied the principle of getting lost to our careers. Since starting our business together, we've sat down a number of times with the intention of planning our next steps. This has always been a relatively difficult exercise because we're much better at picking directions than destinations. In 2007, when we decided to try to make a living on YouTube, there was no guidebook to follow. We didn't know anyone who had tried it. We didn't even know what to call it.
Internet comedy sounded like some sort of pyramid scheme that you recruit your friends into. You can be an internet comedian without leaving your house, adding hundreds of dollars a week to your pockets. Join today. We ended up calling it Internetainment. Regardless of the name, if we had really thought about trying to make a living through online video, we might have convinced ourselves that it was incredibly stupid for two men with wives and children to try such a thing.
All we knew was that we wanted to continue creating together for a small but growing audience, so we kept heading in that direction. As we kept moving, the pieces began to fall into place around us, and most of it was outside of our control or ability to predict. It was a bit like showing up at Chris Barefoot's house. We came out of the woods and just realized we were there.
Since the beginning, nearly every significant development in our career has followed this rule. Moving forward without knowing a specific destination can lead to some pretty remarkable adventures. GMM is no different. More than 1,000 episodes later, it's still becoming whatever it is. In the meantime, we'll keep the Merle mixtape playing and see what county line we cross next. Hopefully it's not Cumberland. Fayetteville has some rough spots.
The best and worst places to get lost.
Without a car or a bike.
We recognize that not all of the mythical beasts in the world have access to Yosemite or Yosemite bicycles or Dodge Dynasties, so we wanted to outline the best and worst places to get lost using other common modes of transportation that might be more accessible to you.
Number one, rollerblades. Best place to get lost on rollerblades? An empty sports arena. The wide, smooth concrete walkways are perfect for blading. You will feel like you are doing time trials at Daytona. Plus, the lack of people means you can blade without a tinge of self-consciousness, commonly known as rollerblading embarrassment. Worst place to get lost on rollerblades, roller skating rink. No matter where you go in the facility, you will be seen as an imposter. Don't risk it.
Number 2. Scooter. Best place to get lost on a scooter, the U.S. Pacific Northwest. Scooters are cool here, and you can always fall into an existing scooter herd if you begin to feel vulnerable. Worst place to get lost on a scooter, southeastern United States. The vehicles are big and the roads are narrow. There is no room, and people might hit you with their trucks just for kicks.
Number 3. Jetpack. Best place to get lost with a jetpack? Anywhere on Earth. Worst place to get lost with a jetpack? The rings of Saturn. Unless you're really good at dodging ice and controlling particle density.
Number 4. Segway. Best place to get lost riding a Segway? Tokyo. Just throw on a cartoon mascot costume and gingerly lean forward. Worst place to get lost riding a Segway? Your ex's family reunion. You would basically be trying to navigate a human minefield of humiliation at roughly 5 miles per hour, most likely while wearing a helmet.
Number 5. Riding a yak. Best place to get lost riding a yak? The Himalayas. Yaks live primarily in the Himalayas, and according to the movies, no one ever dies while riding a yak. They die once they get off the yak. Stay on the yak, and you'll be fine. Worst place to get lost riding a yak? Costco. Good luck trying to get your yak to focus with all those free samples around. Yaks are used to scrounging mountainsides for vegetation. Taking baked sweet potato fries will blow their minds and their digestive systems.
Number 6. Motorcycle sidecar. You cannot technically be lost in a sidecar.
The Wellafiginal.
The mythical beast that never gets lost.
The recent discovery of clustered, regularly interspaced short palindromic repeats, CRISPR for short, DNA editing, has opened up the very real possibility of custom genetically engineered organisms in the not-so-distant future. When that day comes, we plan on trying to talk the scientists into creating a Wellafiginal. Why? Because it will look extremely cool, and it will be the only animal in the world that is literally incapable of losing its whereabouts. Here are the key features of the Wellafiginal.
The echolocation of a whale. Toothed whales, and dolphins, bounce sounds off objects and the seafloor in order to determine their position. Plus, getting inside the Wellafiginal and plunging into the ocean depths like your James Cameron in a submarine seems fun.
The GPS of an elephant. Elephants have incredible spatial reasoning, which allows them to mentally chart the most efficient course to locations up to 20 miles away. They also have a trunk, and putting trunks on genetically engineered animals seems like a good idea.
The electromagnetic navigation skills of a homing pigeon. Homing pigeons are believed to use the magnetite in their beaks to detect magnetic signposts and form a navigational map. Also, the ability to fly means that you'll be able to ride the Wellafiginal around like Falcor from the Neverending Story.
The stereo smelling of a mole. Moles don't see or hear very well, and yet they are able to locate their food very efficiently above or below ground by utilizing their amazing nostrils, which can process and compare smells similarly to how our ears process and compare sounds. Of course, the ability to dig large underground tunnels will make the Wellafiginal a favorite pet of drug cartel kingpins, but nobody's perfect, right?
How to get unlost.
The risk of getting lost for fun is that you end up getting lost for real. We've compiled a list of the places in which people get lost most often, along with the surefire ways to get yourself found.
Number 1. The mall. It's happened to the best of us. You look at the mall map with the "you are here" point marked, and you might as well be looking at ancient Mesopotamian inscriptions. No need to panic. Priority number 1 is food. Follow the smell of every cuisine on Earth mixed together. This will lead you to the food court. Grab all the free samples. Then put your shirt on inside out and grab all the free samples again. Now nourished, follow the distinctly different smell of every perfume on Earth mixed together. This will lead you to one of the department stores on either end of the mall. Do not follow the smell of one perfume because this will lead you directly to a lady who will aggressively sell you said perfume. Avoid her and her cohorts, and move quickly to the parking lot for fresh air. hopefully you park nearby. If not, hitch a ride on a mall cop cart to your vehicle.
Number 2, the zoo, on the path. We've all been there. You're at the zoo and all you want to do is see chimpanzees or the elephants, but the winding pathways get you all turned around until it seems that no matter where you go, you always end up in front of the boring desert reptiles exhibit. Don't worry. All you have to do is wait for a family with four or more children to come by. Families of this size have learned to plan zoo trips meticulously in order to maximize animal sightings and minimize uncoordinated bathroom breaks. Follow them for the rest of the day, and you will see all the cool stuff. Stay at least 50 feet away so as not to frighten them.
Number 3, the zoo, inside the tiger habitat. First things first, recognize that you aren't actually lost. Sure, you feel disoriented, but that's just a result of the concussion you suffered when you fell into the tiger enclosure. No matter, the tigers, yes, there are two of them, are headed your way and they look hungry. Don't waste your time looking at the wall. You can't climb it. The fake swimming hole is a possibility because you've never actually seen the tiger swim in it, but you shouldn't risk that either. Instead, immediately make yourself puke. Nothing is more pungent than vomit consisting of hot dogs, nacho cheese sauce, and churros. It also happens to be a tiger delicacy. When they begin to devour it, climb on their backs and then reach up for the railing. If the large family you have been following is worth their salt, they will have formed a human chain long enough to pull you to safety.
Number 4, in space. First of all, we're going to assume that you are lost well beyond the Milky Way because everyone knows that if you get lost in our galaxy, all you have to do is triangulate your location using the Orion, Perseus, and Sagittarius arms of the galaxy and then ride the solar winds home like you're in the carpool lane. Anyhow, for the sake of argument, let's assume that you're lost in Zebulor or maybe the Varinian system and your transworld navigation system is running low on Chartilium. Check your dead cyborg companion's cache. Did he pack an A490 or a bitty-bitty bot for backup? If so, use them to call out to the closest space junk freighter and drift off into cryosleep for a few light years. If you don't have a dead cyborg companion, or if you're a firstborn albino demi, you'll have to make an emergency landing on the nearest planet and hope that it's inhabited, so you can find someone to eat. Or you can just try your best to wake up because you're clearly dreaming.
Number 5. A new city you've never been to. Try Google Maps or duck into a coffee shop and ask for directions. Chapter 3.
Make a bold hair choice.
There is a huge TV screen just to the right of the camera on the GMM set that displays the video feed of what is being captured. If you've watched the show, you've seen us checking ourselves out in it. We're supposed to use it as a monitor so we can keep things in frame, but we employ it almost exclusively as a mirror to ensure that our coif stay tamed. Our editors could easily create a montage of all the times we've made hair adjustments just before we deliver our show teaser in each episode. It would be at least 10 hours long. If you were to accuse us of caring more about our hair than is normal or necessary, we would have a difficult time defending ourselves.
If and when the apocalypse finally comes, we will gladly toss aside our concerns over our hairstyles or at least adopt a different approach. Extremely intimidating hairdos, like a series of large conical spikes, will potentially be useful for striking fear into rival camps in order to pillage them, but we can discuss that in another book. Currently, we still live in a relatively safe society where fashion and style are legitimate forms of expression. So, it seems like it's not too superficial to write about hairstyles. Pretty superficial, but not embarrassingly so.
Plus, you can't deny that it's a bit strange that we humans have retained hair in just a few strategic places, the main one being right there on the tops of our heads. As long as our species continues to grow this curious skull cover, it's an opportunity to make a statement, a chance to set ourselves apart from one another. And since originality and creativity are hallmarks of mythicality, expressing yourself with your hair is a pretty mythical thing to do. However, this requires making a definitive choice.
This may seem simple, but plenty of people fail to make a decision about their hair and instead let it make the decision for them, allowing their hair to just sort of happen on their heads. As you will soon learn, we were once victims of this kind of hair indecision. Thankfully, we've emerged on the other side. We invite you to join us on a journey through our hair adventures that we hope will be helpful to you, especially if you are presently suffering, as we did, from hair of defeat.
Like most everyone, the first several years of our lives were characterized by our mothers making all hair-related decisions. Based on the available photo evidence, those decisions were limited to simply combing all of our hair straight down in every direction from the crown of our heads. We choose to believe that this was fashionable at the time.
While we began to have some limited say in our hairstyles during our elementary school years, we were still somewhat bound by the places our parents took us to get haircuts.
There was one barbershop in my town, owned and operated by Rudolph Blanchard. My father and brother got their hair cut there, along with 99% of the men in Buies Creek, so I did as well. I would sit down in Rudolph's chair and he would ask me, "What'll it be this time?" It didn't take me long to learn that no matter what I said, Rudolph was going to give me one haircut, the Rudolph. It was a short, simple part. I sported the Rudolph along with nearly every other male in a 3-mile radius for many years. It never failed me.
I was in the 1% of Buies Creek males who didn't go to Rudolph. Instead, my mom took me to Cindy the Beautician, who also cut my mom's hair. Like Rudolph, Cindy apparently knew of only one approach to cutting a boy's hair, but the outcome was distinctly different, the bowl cut. Of course, the bowl cut wasn't a particularly original hairstyle in the 80s for boys of my age, but considering that every other dude had the Rudolph, I really stood out. The normally plain bowl cut almost seemed bold. Even though Cindy would reset the bullishness of my haircut each time I returned to her, the pressure of being surrounded by so many Rudolphs led me to occasionally comb my hair into a more Rudolph-esque part. High school represented a shift to true autonomy in hairstyle management. Unfortunately, having been restrained by the low level of experimentation that Rudolph and Cindy were willing to flirt with, we were slow to push the limits of our hair potential.
I was so overwhelmed with trying to adjust to the spindly, plastic man-like body that puberty had given me that I opted to take a simpler approach to my hair. I maintained what you might call a modified Rudolph, awkwardly straddling the line between an original Rudolph and a total buzz. There was just enough length to indicate that my hair was about to part if it were a little longer, a pre-part, if you will. I was like a flower whose petals were caught in a perpetual state of almost blooming.
I, on the other hand, began to truly express myself. And by express myself, I mean get the same haircut that every guy on the soccer team had. We didn't have a name for it, but the approach was pretty straightforward. It involved growing the hair on the top of your head out to what we considered long, approximately 4 inches, then shaving the sides and back down to buzz level. This resulted in my silhouette closely resembling a mushroom. I love my mushroom hair. When I supplemented it by growing a weak goatee, I was convinced I had achieved the look that I would carry to my grave. It was the perfect hairstyle.
But then we started a band. The Wax Paper Dogs. Yes, that's right. Dogs with a Z. It was 1994. Switching S's to Z's was fashionable at the time. Over a very short stint, our band tore through a number of musical genres, including 70s easy listening, country, and classic rock, eventually settling into some kind of 311 rip-off rap-funk rock thing. While our music didn't get us anywhere near a record contract, it did send us into a whole new world of coiffure.
Taking more than just our musical cues from 311, we decided to make the much less original than we thought at the time move of bleaching our hair. This started us down a road that left our scalps burned and blistered more than a few times. We were so keen on achieving that platinum blonde look that we came up with a process that included bleaching our hair twice, dyeing it blue, then bleaching it again. This ensured that there were little to no traces of yellow left, just white, brittle, hideous hair, sections of which would just break off and blow in the wind like a dandelion. We began to treat our poor hair like a canvas, even donning red, white, and blue for a mind-blowing performance on the stage at the town of Lillington's 1996 Fourth of July celebration. We were so cool.
College at NC State University was a time of further hair experimentation. We both majored in engineering, me in civil, Lincoln industrial, and our rather boring studies may explain why we oscillated between a number of hairstyles, sometimes sporting the bleach look from our band days, while occasionally assuming tight buzz cuts. Interestingly, we each had poofy hair for a time, which would be an early precursor to my current hairstyle. Our only hair rule in college was that we couldn't commit to any style for too long. We had to keep changing and keep our concerned relatives concerned.
When we graduated and began to work as engineers, our previously expressive and dynamic hair configurations began to settle into a very sad state. It's as if our hair was some kind of indicator as to what was going on inside of our souls as we toiled away at mind-numbing calculation after calculation. Naturally, there was a bit of an expectation as to what kind of hair was acceptable among junior engineers. Nowhere was it stated that our hair needed to assume a lifeless and unprovocative appearance, but given that we were required to wear collared shirts tucked into dress pants, it was clear enough. These were our unfortunate days of hair indecision.
Remarkably, we both adopted the same haircut. We never discussed it or planned it. One day we were living wild and free as college students, never knowing what hairstyle was coming next, and then, all of a sudden, we were sitting in cubicles with totally uninspired mats of hair on our heads. We'd given up on making a statement with our hair. But make no mistake, hair is always making a statement. During those days, ours only said, "This is hair." We had hair of defeat.
When we made the decision to leave engineering for good to start working together in comedy, our hair slowly began to come back from the dead. The more we became locked into this new career together, the more our hair responded. Just like it had symbolized our discontent during those engineering days, our hair began to signal that we were finally realizing our dream of creating together. We were ushering in a new hair era. A new hera. That should be a word.
It was at this point that my hair began to literally reach for the skies. Like I mentioned before, I had briefly tried a poofy updo in college one summer, but I lost heart upon returning to school in the fall. This time was different. When I applied massive amounts of pomade to convince my hair to defy gravity, I was saying, "Look at me. I'm an already freakishly tall man who is using his hair to make himself obscenely tall by adding a full 2 inches to his stature." Eventually, I would even abandon my horrid chin strap by growing a full beard, finally settling into the look that most mythical beasts are familiar with.
My hair also began to reach new heights, but not by going up, no. My hair sprouted wings and took flight. My wings could have never flown in my engineering job where I had to be taken seriously, but afterward, my hair was released like a carrier pigeon with a message. That message was, "I am an internet comedian, and I'm not even sure that's a real job, but it means I can have hair like this." Alas, after nearly a decade of letting my hair fly around the internet, I decided that it was time to ground the bird. I think I had said everything I wanted to say with that particular hairstyle, and honestly, I believe it might have overstayed its welcome. And so, in late 2015, I clipped my wings. Even though I've been in this business long enough to know how much the internet is resistant to change, I had no way of anticipating the level of reaction to my decision. But I had no regrets. It was time for my hair to say something new about me. I'm still not entirely sure what my new hair says. Maybe it says, "I was tired of my old haircut, and I think this new one looks pretty cool." I trust its message will be revealed over time.
In early 2017, I embarked on my latest hera. My hair has always been a bit wavy, but I've spent most of my life attempting to calm the seas with combs and blow dryers. After years of resistance, I made the decision to let my hair follow its heart, if only for a time. The hair wants what the hair wants, and apparently my hair wants to look like the North Atlantic during a squall. Who am I to stand in its way?
Who knows what shapes our hair will take in the future? We reserve the right to change our hairstyles as we age, even if that means bringing back the Rudolph. But that's not the point. The bottom line is that we escaped the depths of the valley of hair indecision, and we are currently exercising our freedom to definitively sculpt our manes into whatever style we choose.
You may not be free at this particular time to experiment with your hair. Maybe you have a job with certain guidelines, or if you're still living at home, your parents may have a say in your hairstylings. Working within those particular parameters is totally fine, but just make sure that you're not currently experiencing hair of defeat. Make a bold decision about your hair and go for it.
It won't be easy. Hair indecision is actually very common, and having it can be a way to fit in. But if you want your hair to be mythical by saying something about you or serve as an indication of the way you feel, then make the change. When you finally enter your own new Hera, you'll be glad you overcame your hair indecision. And if for some reason you end up regretting it, just shave it all off. It'll probably grow back.
The Chin Strap, A Tale of Regret. I inherited a weak chin from my mom's side of the family, and ever since I discovered hair growing on the lower half of my face,